Hey Tess.
Hello.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I really just want you to kick off by saying what your background is and how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, so my official background is aerospace engineering undergrad and then a PhD in earth and planetary science. But during that time, I had a lot of health issues and ended up having a major remission from the health issues. So, we might talk about that a bit. But that caused me to get really interested in medical research and human health. And I got involved in the Ancestral Health Symposium. And so I've been involved in that since 2011. And then in 2020, I actually left my engineering job and became an independent patient advocate, directly helping people navigate the healthcare system. And then I started getting involved in medical research. And so that's what I'm doing now. I'm doing some self-experimentation, and then also I'm a patient consultant on some more official research projects.
Amazing. Yeah, I came across what you're doing recently, specifically around the kind of self-experimentation and encouraging other people to self-experiment and to test themselves around chronic fatigue syndrome ME. And people who've listened to my podcast before might have heard me talk about my mentor or heard him being on the podcast, the physics professor Ken Strain, who, when I didn't complete my physics PhD, but I started one, and he was one of my supervisors, and he remains a friend now. And he healed his chronic fatigue syndrome ME using diet. So he went from bedridden, told he'd never work again, to running 10Ks in like 6 months. So there was this remission that his doctors were obviously happy about, but couldn't have advised them how to do, couldn't have predicted, probably had never seen before, except maybe very rarely in their career in a way they couldn't explain. And he'd made changes to his diet along the lines of sort of Gary Tobbs, good calories, bad calories, like low carb stuff. And he developed this side interest in nutrition that he was able to kind of pass on to me to an extent and point me in the right direction. And the chronic fatigue syndrome ME is such an amazing area because it's really sad how it's kind of an umbrella term for a group of illnesses, right, that are kind of characterized by chronic fatigue, among other things. And there's different sort of ways into it and different causes, and it'd be great to hear you talking about that. But as a patient population, they're often just left to fend for themselves. And when I was looking into how to potentially supplement for better health when I was supporting my recovery, one of the places that there is the most information online about supplements is the Chronic Fatigue Syndrome ME community forums, like Phoenix Rising, for example. And they have become experts in their own bodies and the human body. So I know that was a kind of thought salad, but could you talk about chronic fatigue syndrome ME and your experience of it and the world of kind of online chronic fatigue syndrome patients?
So I didn't know what chronic fatigue syndrome was until 2020, even though looking back, I had it for a really long time. And so since I didn't know it, I kept pushing myself throughout the years and would get worse. And when I started learning about it, I'd heard of people say chronic fatigue syndrome, but I had no idea what that actually meant. I thought that it was just like a diagnosis of exclusion and that it was something that nobody really understood anything about. And then as a scientist, I started diving into all of the literature about it. And I'll refer it to it as ME/CFS, so myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome. So that's what a lot of the patients like it to be called. And when I started reading about it, I started learning about how much science there actually is behind it. And one of the symptoms that is, it's really specific to ME/CFS is something called post-exertional malaise. And that means that if you exert yourself too much, you actually get worse. All your symptoms can get worse. Even though it's called malaise, it's like all your symptoms get worse. It's not just the fatigue or malaise part of it. And so when I started learning about that and realizing that there's tests that can actually be done for that, all of a sudden it was like, oh, there might actually be something to this where there's underlying pathophysiology that like really does make up ME/CFS, even though people can come into it and get triggered by many different causes, that there could be something that is actually going on, you know, physically, biologically, that is leading to these sort of symptoms. And there are criteria used to diagnose ME/CFS. So it's not just the diagnosis of exclusion that I thought it was. So when I started learning about this in 2020, I looked at these criteria and I was like, okay, I meet these. Yeah. A lot of times I'll say like, I meet the criteria for ME/CFS because there's a lot of stigma around it. And so even just saying like, I have ME/CFS is kind of hard for me sometimes because people that don't know a lot about it really don't take it seriously. And like you were mentioning, the patients are just in a really bad situation because they aren't taken seriously. And a lot of times it's thought of as psychological. And people are prescribed like graded exercise therapy, which, you know, you're supposed to slowly build up. But for people that do have this post-exertional malaise, that really doesn't work. Because when you try to build up, you get worse. And as someone who is a former athlete and spent a lot of time in the gym slowly building up and getting better, that was really hard for me to understand at first. But I've read enough about it now and I've talked to enough patients that I really do believe that there's something to it, that when you do exert yourself, there's stuff going on that has been, there's been a lot of measurements of like metabolism, metabolites, immune changes, so that you really aren't improving. You can't just slowly build up and get fitter. And so that's something that, you know, it kind of goes against what we're taught, that, you know, if you have fatigue, if you're not feeling well, exercise is going to help no matter what. And I don't think that's true for people that have ME/CFS.
Yeah, that's really interesting because, you know, it's sad that on the one hand, there's people who don't take it seriously, who think it's psychological, who try to kind of bend the facts around some kind of malingering or, diagnosis like that, where it's psychological. Or this wrong-headed kind of graded exercise therapy. At the other end of things, there's stigma potentially around how it may be like a chronic lifelong diagnosis that you're something of a write-off, which is almost the opposite problem, you know. Ooh. That instead of it kind of being underestimated as an issue, it may be being overestimated because there are potential ways out. People in the Phoenix Rising Forum would routinely talk about partial or complete remission and talk about people who'd had success. I mean, like a lot of places on the internet, you know, if you've got physics experience, you probably have experience of going on to Substack or something like that. Stack Exchange, and trying to find the solution to a computing problem. And you get all these potential solutions and no one ever goes back and says, oh, this worked, thank you. They always just take the potential solution. You find that on chronic fatigue syndrome forums as well. You've got all these potential solutions and you might have literally hundreds that you think, oh, well, I could try that. So that's why it's so interesting to talk about metabolites and about measurements, because if there's a way to reliably and reproducibly predict and test treatments, then that demystifies a lot of this. And so that's kind of what you're doing right now, isn't it?
Yeah. So like you were mentioning, there's sort of the thought that this is lifelong, that you're not going to be able to ever fix it. And the only way to really keep it from getting worse is to not push yourself at all. And I can understand that. People try so much. There's, you know, people that have had this for decades and they have tried one thing after another and nothing works. And so I completely understand where those people are coming from. But, you know, I had remission. I know it's possible because I personally experienced it. And since we learned about this, these different remission events, we've been collecting stories of a lot of people that have had remissions. And a lot of them are from antibiotics, which is what mine was originally from. But there's also different things, like FMT, fecal microbiota transfer.
I was actually pioneered in my hometown of Glasgow.
Oh yeah, really?
Or C. difficile. Yeah, you maybe knew that, but that I've mentioned it on the podcast before. C. difficile, dreadful, often a hospital acquired infection that can kill, and the fecal transplant is 96% effective at completely healing folk, but there is some preliminary kind of or there is some evidence that you can transplant positive and negative features of another individual through their microbiome. So there's definitely such power there. And so I didn't realize that there'd been chronic fatigue remission from FMT. That's fascinating. Besides, those, are there any other seeming causes of remission?
So another interesting one, colonoscopy prep. So another one related to the gut. You know, we're using antibiotics, but another way to sort of clean out the gut. And, you know, people had no idea that was going to happen. They were supposed to get colonoscopies for other reasons, and then all of a sudden their ME/CFS went away just from doing the prep part of it.
Wow.
So that was super interesting. There's been, so we talk about different levels of remission. So what we experienced of like night and day, of like I went to sleep feeling horrible, nearly bedbound one day, and I woke up the next day and felt like I had more energy since I had a kid, or since I was a kid. And we call that level 2 remission. So that's like everything is better, all your symptoms are gone. And then level 1 remission, it's like you're way better, your symptoms are gone, but it's not like you have extra energy like that. So when I'm talking about the remissions, I'm thinking about these level 2 remissions where it's like you feel amazing. It's like everything is gone. One interesting one is from a medication called aprepitant. And so that's a friend of mine that is helping us with our experiments now. And he had ME/CFS. He took this medication. It's supposed to be for nausea. And he had one of these level 2 events where just like a few days after starting it, all of a sudden everything is gone. And so there's some other cases like that of different medications that I'm not remembering off the top of my head right now.
What do those ones do in the body?
Yeah, so we're digging into that now because we think each of these anecdotes is a clue about what might be happening. And so with aprepitant, it seems to be able to block receptors in the brain that sort of so TLR4 that LPS, lipopolysaccharide, can trigger. So with the medication, you might be directly going and blocking that reaction. So it sort of relates to our hypotheses of stuff going on in the gut, LPS, systemic inflammation, neuroinflammation. And So that one's super interesting. And we're actually collecting some samples from him because he has this every time he takes a prep attempt. So we're actually having him collect some samples and he's going to send them to us. And then we're running all of our samples. We're having this company called Metabolon, which measures 1,000+ metabolites to try to really understand what's happening with our metabolism when these remissions occur. So we'll have, so far we'll have 5 people who we will send in samples for. So myself, Tamara, my experiment partner, and Isabel, who did the experiment with us, and then someone else who happened to get prescribed the same antibiotic and had the same experience. And we told her, collect some urine. We're going to run some of your samples. So it's been really fun being able to actually do this ourselves. I could go on many different tangents, but I've done self-experimentation for a really long time, mostly for myself, trying to figure out how to get myself better. And like from all different angles, diet, exercise, posture. But it was always like just trying one thing at a time on myself. So it feels very different what we're doing it in a methodical way of like, we have this plan for exactly what we're going to do. We're going to make all these different measurements. We're going to analyze it in a scientific way and publish it. And so it's been really interesting. It's been fun. And really excited about what we're doing.
Yeah, it's such a great start because, you know, some people kind of balk at anecdotes, but if you have a condition which is thought to be chronic and you have these level 2 events, then that needs to be explained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been funny when we've been talking about our experiment to traditional researchers, you know, people that are in academia. And we get questions like, well, how are you going to know which intervention caused it? Because you're doing multiple at the same time. And we're like, if these are rare events, we want to just first show that we can actually trigger them and test as much as we can on these individual people. And then what we learn from that, we can turn into larger trials and you can do it in a more traditional way. And yeah, it's you mentioning anecdotes. It's like we're going after the outliers instead of a lot of people, you know, throwing out the outliers. Mm-hmm. We're considering multiple hypotheses at the same time instead of picking one hypothesis. So we're measuring as much as we can to cross off hypotheses instead of picking one and just trying to test that. So it's kind of like we're flipping a lot of how traditional research is done. And so we get a lot of questions from people, but people are also really excited about it. We've gotten a ton of support from both the patient community and the research community. And the researchers, I think they're like, well, I couldn't do that myself, but that's awesome that you're doing it. Like, this is gonna give us good information that we wouldn't be able to get otherwise. You know, what we're doing, we're measuring, we have like 20 something panels that we're doing, multiple different interventions at the same time. So like probiotics, some supplements that are good for neuroinflammation. So you'd never see anything like this if we weren't doing a self-experiment like this.
And are you doing the multiple interventions one per person, or are you stacking them in individuals too?
We're stacking them. Yeah, so we think that ME/CFS is sort of a systems problem. So it's not just like one thing is going wrong and you can take one intervention and that's going to fix everything. So we're trying to hit the system from multiple different angles at the same time. So, you know, if the system's stuck in a weird state where multiple different things are going wrong, then it's like we're going to hit the neuroinflammation, we're going to hit the gut, we're going to try to kick the system into a different state that's a healthier one. And so we took a bunch of different interventions. We're also doing like vagus nerve stimulation. And then as more people self-experiment and try this, people are doing slightly different versions of it, depending on what supplements they're able to get. And so from having a bunch of different people self-experiment, we can then narrow down, like, what's the minimum amount that we could do to trigger one of these interventions. So we're just getting started with that. You know, we did this experiment in March, ended it in like mid-April. And so it's just been over a month now of analyzing our data and having some people reach out to us who said, I happened to get prescribed amoxiclav and I took some probiotics and I did this and I had one of these remission events. And so, yeah, there's a lot we're going to do. We have really big dreams and we think that this sort of research that's driven by patients and done with self-experimentation is going to really be able to tell us a lot about the mechanisms and the pathophysiology of it that then researchers can take and run with if they want to test it in other ways.
Yeah, I agree. I think having a holistic view of the human is realistic. You know, the idea that we should test just one variable doesn't seem right to me. I agree that it's a system problem. And of course, there may be a time component so that one system has a turnover rate or a healing rate, if you like, of hours or days, and then other systems have turnover or healing rates of weeks, months, years. And so this is when, you know, going sort of edging back towards diet, when people talk about, for example, these remission events, if you want to call it that, a level 2 remission event in bipolar disease, bipolar disorder, then you find that some people just need a sort of off the shelf keto diet to do that.
Yeah.
Whereas other people, they need to have a carnivore diet. Other people at first need a carnivore diet and then can go on to a normal keto diet and then can even just have a sort of clean paleo diet. So there's, you know, this sort of the Heraclitean thing of a person can try and dive in the same river twice, but it's not the same person. It's not the same river. Mm-hmm. And this system can change over time and the subsystems too. So clearly larger experimental numbers of participants is a positive if it's properly tracked, because then you can really understand how the individual might vary over time with different systems and different damage and a different background of, you know, stress, trauma, gut microbiome, et cetera, et cetera. So there's clearly a lot of moving parts and more numbers is a good thing, but you have to start somewhere, don't you? And, you know, you talked about the Ancestral Health Summit and how you did stuff with diet. To what extent did that help you? And to what extent do you find that results in level 2 events just talking about diet?
I actually haven't met anybody who had a level 2 just from diet. So, but diet is very important to me. So I'll kind of go back. Long story, so I'll try to keep it short. But the same time that I took antibiotics in 2009, when I had my first remission event, I also went gluten-free. And so for the past 13 years, I thought that it was going gluten-free that had caused my remission. I didn't think the antibiotics had anything to do with it. And so I've been on a gluten-free diet since then. I will the rest of my life. I know I have the genes for celiac. I have multiple relatives who have it. But I don't think it was just going gluten-free that did it. I think there had to be something that would kick the system into a different state. So I think there's like underlying issues that can be fixed with diet. And maybe for some people, that's enough. But yeah, so I went gluten-free. I felt amazing. I had this remission event where I, like I said, I jumped out of bed. I felt like a kid again. Within the next 6 months to a year, I was winning triathlons. So I went from bedbound to just feeling great. And so I got into the paleo diet then because I was tired of trying to read labels and find gluten-free foods. So I went paleo. I started listening to all the podcasts. Rob Wolf was my favorite. And then in 2011, I found out about the Ancestral Health Symposium, and it was sold out. So I was devastated. I was like, all my heroes are going to be there. I really want to go. And I just started contacting people and saying, can I volunteer? I'll do anything. Can I get a ticket? Can I get a wait list? And so I ended up being a volunteer that first year in 2011. And there were so many amazing speakers. Gary Tobbs was one of them. And so I was just obsessed with diet and nutrition. And then with the Ancestral Health Symposium, I started learning about a bunch of different things that can help your system. And I am still involved in it. I'm president now. So I like slowly took on more, and throughout the years just added on interventions that helped me feel better. I ended up finding out that ketosis does make me feel the best. So I know when I would go into ketosis, I would be near a level 2 event. I would feel like I had tons of energy. My brain was working better. But I say that I don't think for me and for a lot of people I've talked to that just diet has done it. So I look back and I still had ME/CFS through all of this time. It was just mild. And I didn't know what it was at the time. I didn't know that when I was working out and trying to do these triathlons and trying to build up strength in the gym, that I was feeling exhausted from it a lot of times. I was like, oh, this is normal. I'm pushing myself. I'm going to the gym. But looking back, that was post-exertional malaise. I would do training, and then the next day I wouldn't be able to think. I would have a hard time doing my PhD work. And I really think that that was mild ME/CFS that was still underlying, that didn't go away with my first remission, and that I had for a really long time that would kind of go up and down in symptoms. All that being said, I think diet is huge for people. I think I would say people have level 1 remissions from it, where all symptoms do go away. I know I have a lot of friends who do the carnivore diet. I am friends with Amber O'Hearn. And yeah, so carnivore, keto, paleo, I think that they are super helpful for people. I think with a lot of people with ME/CFS, there's kind of a pushback against it because people are so sick, people are bedbound, that when you suggest that changing your diet could get rid of symptoms, people are like, you're not taking me seriously then. Like, you don't understand how sick I really am if you think diet's going to fix this. And I understand that. I can see where people are coming from. And I also do believe that there's probably a lot of people who have tried these diets and really done it correctly, and it wasn't enough. And since we're looking at it as you need to stock on multiple different interventions, I think diet is a big one that can help a lot of people, but you might need to do more than that to really get into level 1 remission. So it's I feel like I'm in between two worlds, like the ancestral health stuff where people are like, this is going to fix everything. And then the other world where people are really sick and they've tried all these things and they're like, that's not going to help at all. You know, they'll like laugh if you say, oh, you're going to recommend yoga for me when I'm bedbound, like, you know, changing my diet, doing meditation. These are not serious enough interventions to actually help me.
And yeah. Yeah, like David Unwin talks about telling his colleagues over the years how he was sending people's type 2 diabetes into remission, and he was deprescribing antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs and anti-hypertensive drugs. And you could see as the list went on, his colleagues' eyes glazing over because they didn't want to be rude to him, but they thought there's no way that this could work. So on the other end of things, you may have patients who just have lost hope that these types of interventions could really be the one, because people trying to be helpful constantly tell you what you can do, you know, from the most inane smile it might never happen type suggestion, all the way through to esoteric mistletoe injections, or you name it, and everything in between. So how are you meant to know? And it's just like going on the Phoenix Rising forums. Am I really going to try the 3 dozen protocols, some of which involve, you know, collating heavy metals based on hair mineral analysis and all this stuff that sounds plausible, but you just have no idea. And, you know, I think a lot of people make the mistake of forgetting that, you know, in systems analysis, you very often have this thing called hysteresis, don't you, where there's a way a system begins and some force acts on it, or something acts on it to change it. And then if you try to apply the opposite force to the system, it doesn't necessarily take it back to where it started. And so I think that is key to understanding human health and thinking about ancestral health, that a human who has gone through multiple rounds of antibiotics in their life, they might have been born C-section and their gut was inoculated by the hands of the person delivering the baby. They were, you know, bottle fed, really sort of nutritionally poor formula. They were fed, you know, in the Western food environment for 20 or 30 years. And then you think that if you just go paleo, then that's going to solve all of that. No, there's hysteresis. The gut is resistant to change. And although I hadn't heard about it, it's not a surprise to me that the full microbiota transplant has helped there. You know, like looking at the work of Weston Price, or one of my favorite books is Primitive Man and His Foods by Arnold de Vries, which is like a compendium of explorers over the last few hundred years, and looking at so-called primitive people and their foods. You know, traditional societies weren't tapped into the modern food and drug environment. They were in excellent health into old age. I don't need to tell you all this part of the ancestral health symposium, but they had a variety of diets. You know, very few of them were pure carnivores, or even regularly. Maybe some of them were regularly in ketosis, but there's a lot of people who had lots of starch, lots of fruit, very healthy, no sign of chronic illness. So in theory, we should be able to kick the system back into some state where that can be true again, right?
Yeah, except it's so hard with our modern environment. So one of the main ways that the Ancestral Health Symposium looks at the problem is evolutionary mismatch. Like you were mentioning, the people who were living more traditional lives and traditional foods and community and all these different ways that are more evolutionary matched to our biology. It just makes sense to me that would be a way to change the system. One of the big researchers in ME/CFS is Dr. Navio, and he talks about something called the cell danger response. And so I think about it like our modern environment, our modern foods, they're all triggering this cell danger response. And it, for some people, if they're so sensitive to these things, no matter what you're doing, you're still going to have things in the modern environment that are going to trigger you. So it's hard. You know, people's systems respond in different ways. And for some people, just changing the diet might be enough. For other people, maybe they're reacting to, you know, pollutants in the environment that they're hard to get rid of, you know? And so I wish that it could work for everybody. You know, I'm president of the Ancestral Health Symposium, Ancestral Health Society. And I think that it's an amazing way to look at human health and current diseases. But I also think of it as like, you know, maybe if you were doing these things your whole life, you would never get to a disease state. But like you mentioned, if you do get to that disease state, you can't necessarily just rewind it in the same way. One of the ways that I think about this, or one example, is posture is really important to me. I follow Esther Gokhale, who's presented many times at the Ancestral Health Symposium. And I personally think that if I would have had good posture my whole life, I wouldn't have any issues with my neck. But I do, because my neck structurally changed through all the bad posture. And now I work on good posture. I'm working on trying to get my neck back into a good position. But there's damage done there. And so if you have damage done in a permanent way, doing the intervention that originally might have stopped you from getting to that point might not be enough. And so that's also sort of where I think about how modern medicine can match with ancestral health, that if you get to this point where doing the ancestral interventions isn't enough, you might need modern medicine to turn things back around, along with the ancestral interventions.
Yeah, and the modern measurements, you know, you've talked about testing these large panels of metabolites. And I think there is a bit of a hunt and an interest in understanding which ones indicate what, because if ME/CFS is an umbrella term for several potential routes into that set of symptoms, then there may be multiple metabolites to look out for. And if you can identify a metabolite or a set of metabolites that tend to correspond best with a remission, then great. So, thinking particularly about mitochondria, and Dr. Sarah Myhill was someone whose website I devoured early on. And her book, It's Not Hypochondria, It's Mitochondria, kind of sums up a lot about what people are looking at the moment with metabolic mental health. And it was, you know, as a physicist, what appealed to me about hyperlipid, Peter Dobromilsky's blog, where he talks about protons in his sort of legendary protons thread, where he talks about the origins of life and how mitochondria are so well suited to saturated fat as a fuel. And you learn so much about the mitochondrial dynamics and how they can go wrong in a modern food and drug environment.
Mitochondria are definitely key. I think we don't understand the whole pathophysiology, but mitochondrial dysfunction is definitely a part of it.
Yeah, it's funny because you build mitochondria constantly, and you set points on how many to build and what quality and what kind of fuel they're going to accept. And for people that get better quickly with diet, it can be that the turnaround is very quick. So it may be that the triggers involved in mitochondrial genesis are can turn over quite quickly, and that perhaps stuff in the gut is slower to turn around. Does that kind of chime with your experience?
Maybe. Yeah, we're not really sure yet. But for mitochondria, sorry, I'm kind of taking on a tangent, but I was just thinking while you were talking, back to Dr. Navio and the cell danger response. He studies mitochondria. But he also mentions that from an evolutionary perspective, that maybe these mitochondria are downregulating because that's adaptive, that's actually helping you in certain situations. And so I always kind of keep that in mind as I'm thinking about these things, like you might have an intervention that upregulates the mitochondria, gives you more energy, but is that hiding an underlying cause that you also need to go after? Maybe, you know, maybe you're just, your body is sort of perceiving that things are better, but they're actually not. But there could still be something going on in your body that you're not taking care of. So I think, you know, all of this is like one giant puzzle. How does this all work together? How do you get into these different system states? And there's so much we don't understand. So yeah, I do think mitochondria key. I met Terry Walls at the second Ancestral Health Symposium, who I think her book is Minding My Mitochondria. And as I'm reading about a bunch of things, I keep coming across mitochondria. And I feel like I don't completely understand the full picture yet myself. I love reading in many different fields and trying to make connections between different things and thinking about the evolutionary perspective and how that might teach us what's really happening and what might be adaptive. And that will teach us how we might want to go back and change the system.
Yeah, it's like, like when you're talking about your experience of really kind of still having some of the post-exertional malaise and realizing more recently that actually, yeah, you may have revved up your mitochondria by dialing in your diet, but there's still something under there. And I'm thinking about, on the evolutionary adaptation side, thinking about Brad Marshall, who talks a lot about torpor or a kind of a form of hibernation. Where you've taken a particular type of fat in combination with certain other nutrients or macronutrients, and you know you've kind of switched on a mammalian hibernation mode. And I think there is really compelling evidence for that, and that it might take a bit to, and you know, that using that term, kick you out of it. You know, like a reboot. This type of language comes up again and again from different angles.
Yeah, I keep mentioning Navio. So he has measured metabolites in MECFS and found out that it looks like a state of, he calls it dour. So it's similar along those lines of torpor, hibernation, that the specific metabolites he's seeing, he does think sort of fit in that category. So I definitely think there's something to it. I think it's interesting, and thinking about how the system being in an alternate state, it makes sense to me that you would evolutionarily be prone to be able to get into these other states because they were adaptive. So, you know, our ancestors going way back, hibernation could be helpful. And so our biochemistry might still be set up to be able to be kicked into that sort of state. You know, even though we're not hibernating now, I think that that's a good way to think about it, is that you can have different system states due to underlying biochemistry that it's trying to do what it's supposed to do.
Did I read this on your Twitter, or was it somewhere else? And have you seen this about a village in, I think it might've been Siberia, and they would in the winter, they would just kind of close up shop and occasionally wake up to have a potato, and the rest of the time they were asleep.
Yeah, so that probably wasn't on my Twitter. I don't think I've tweeted that, but I have heard of that, came across it, but I haven't dug into it. Super interesting though. I wonder if anybody studied them and actually tried to make measurements while this was happening.
Yeah, or you know, again in Scotland, we certainly do things at the extreme. The longest fast ever was Angus Barbieri, who was massively overweight, but they only gave him fluids and some nutrients to make sure he was okay, and he fasted for over a year, I believe, and came back down to normal weight. So you know, it's in us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you wonder, is this actually an evolutionary adaptation that we are accidentally triggering with the modern food and drug environment?
Yep. I think that's definitely a possibility. The other state, the system state that I think about a lot is called sickness behavior. So it's another adaptive state when you get an acute infection that your body purposely goes into to save energy for the immune system. And, you know, this is seen in animals and in people, like when it's the feeling of like, you just want to rest and body-wide pain. And so like a lot of the symptoms, if you look at sickness behavior, they match up with ME/CFS. Not all of them, but you could imagine your body is good at getting into this state because we would have had a lot of acute infections throughout history. And maybe people are better at it. Maybe people get stuck in it for some reason. Or maybe there's, with our modern environment, there's constant triggers that are sending people's body into getting into this state. And so, yeah, there's definitely a lot of overlap between like sickness behavior, lower metabolism, and torpor, hibernation. And so it's definitely like metabolism is an interesting part of it. It's going to be super interesting to see what our metabolites look like when we get those results back.
Yeah, one of the most promising ones is lactate. And, you know, you're measuring it, right? And you know, do you think it's a coincidence that bipolar researchers are starting to look at lactate too?
I didn't know that. They're finding high lactate levels in bipolar?
There's some work brewing around that.
I'll have to check that out. Yeah, you... Oh, I was trying to think, do you want to hear more about the acid test, lactate measurement?
So
with after we Tamara and I came up with the Mission Biome project, right away we had this idea of like, this could be a model for other types of research, patients doing self-experimentation and sharing the data, pooling it and analyzing it. And so one of the new projects that came out is called hashtag the acid test. And it's people with ME/CFS and long COVID using at-home lactate measuring devices, and many of them finding high lactate levels. And this has also been published. So it was known before that there can be high lactate levels in these conditions. There looks like there's probably subsets though. So it's not the case in everybody. For me personally, most of my measurements are normal. I mean, maybe that's because I'm in remission now, but even when we are measuring it during our antibiotics experiment, most of mine were normal. I think I only had one that was high, and I'm not sure if I believe it.
It can vary, can't it, throughout the day, and can be quite hard to measure, right? Compared to some other blood tests.
Yeah, we have one guy who's doing it and tweeting about it who did 17 measurements in one day, all throughout the day. And he found multiple spikes, but the rest of them, like out of the 17, I think he had 4 or 5 really high spikes. The rest of them were more normal, like right kind of on the edge of high. So that's another thing too, thinking about these sort of patient-led self-experiments, is that you can do them at home and you can catch things like this that would be hard to catch in a lab. You know, if you go in for one lactate measurement in the morning, maybe you happen to be in the state where it's low, and you'll never know that your body 5 times a day goes into these high lactate states. Pretty much everything that we've been doing is home sampling. So we actually had a phlebotomist come to our house, and we're like I mentioned, sending biosamples to Canada and Germany ourselves. And it's going to be really cool too, for particularly for ME/CFS and people who get post-exertional malaise, because you want to measure during the post-exertional malaise, and it's kind of hard to predict it. So it's hard to study. And so if people have devices themselves at home where they can collect blood, that's going to be huge. That's going to give us a lot of information about changes that happen during these different states. But yeah, so lactate, we're still in the beginning of this like data collection phase. But even just showing that it's high in a lot of people is helpful to push the research forward, but also for individuals who have been told that there's nothing wrong with them and that all their blood work is normal, to actually have something to go show their doctor and say, hey, look at this. My lactate level was 6. And so we've actually had some doctors acting on this now and giving treatments and people feeling better and their lactate levels lowering.
Amazing.
So yeah, super, super interesting.
So interesting, isn't it? How sometimes the technology isn't particularly advanced to detect these things. It just needs the right tool at the right time. You know, I'm thinking about for diabetes, you can take all sorts of glucose measurements and it doesn't tell you very much about people's health state. But if you take the Kraft insulin assay, where you take a bolus of oral glucose and then you measure insulin over the next few hours at different data points, then that's all you need more or less to understand how unhealthy that person is. And that is the test that we should be doing. And yet, even when you know it, sometimes it just doesn't filter into the community. So how's the response been to, you know, this sort of idea that lactate might be a key indicator?
I think a lot of people think it's important. They believe that these high levels are accurate. We actually have some researchers who are themselves sick who are doing these measurements and being very careful about it, doing everything properly and finding their high lactate levels and really starting to build up a picture of when it happens based on their activity and everything. So I would say overall, like, people think that there's something to this. And I think that it is going to push the research forward. Like I said, there was already papers written about this the past few years, like a handful of them. And there's another patient who recently wrote a hypothesis paper, which the hypothesis paper is sort of what kicked off the acid test. We're probably up to 100 people now who have devices who are doing these measurements. So it's going to be really fascinating to see how this does move forward. This is the way we're doing this is new. You know, people have been self-experimenting forever, but bringing the group together and doing large numbers of data collection, I think, hasn't really been done much before. Like I people have asked me, who are you looking to come up with the model? And we don't know. I guess one is Dave Feldman. I don't know if you follow him and his cholesterol test. So he's probably the number one person there, you know, not doing at home. Well, he's doing at home ketone testing. So he's probably the closest there. But since we're like, this is pretty new, we're trying to figure out how to do this, we're not sure what's going to happen, how this is going to affect what people understand about lactate in these conditions and how it's going to inform future research and treatments. So we're figuring it out.
And yeah, it's great because it's not just new science. It's this kind of new way of doing it at the same time. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. I also mentioned too, so, and it isn't just patients doing this experimentation on their own. There are researchers interested in this who are saying, oh, wow, this, I would love to look at this data. This is something that would be hard for me to capture myself. So for the acid test, we actually have an academic at a university who just sent in for IRB approval for collecting and analyzing the acid test data. So it's going to be interesting to find out how these partnerships end up too, and the different balance between completely patient-led and partnering with universities, which I think that's what Dave Feldman was doing. And so what I interrupted you though, what were you going to say?
No, it's good to, it's always good to get more information. Yeah, the thing that brings kind of, I feel like it brings it all together is the gut. You know, I know researchers who are looking to do interventions where it's, you know, a keto diet, but the ultimate aim is to get the gut right to allow people to eat an ancestrally consistent diet and still feel good, even if they've had the benefits of a ketogenic diet for example, bipolar disorder or similar. So, you know, I've seen a lot of success with people using kind of over-the-counter antimicrobial or antifungal pills like oil of oregano, grapeseed extract, berberine, these types of things. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any good results, you know, spoken about in ME/CFS with that? And then maybe thinking about probiotics, it's my understanding that there's kind of, broadly speaking, two dominant strains, and that some people find they do well on one, some people find they do well on the other. And quite often it's kind of like in a bad neighborhood, if the police are around, then there's no crimes committed. But then when you stop taking the probiotics and the police aren't there anymore, then the bad element comes back. So first, have you noticed any anecdotes of people getting better using things like oil of oregano, berberine, and so on, and then maybe thinking about probiotics, which might be the next step for people?
So yes, we have found a few people who had these sort of level 2 remission events from over-the-counter antimicrobials. So one of them is actually someone who's currently having remissions on Twitter. This is from Amoxiclav because she had an acute infection, but last fall she had put together her own over-the-counter protocol and did get remission from it. And it's really interesting for us because it's going to be hard to get doctors or providers to prescribe antibiotics for a long time, you know, until we have the bigger studies. Most people won't be able to go to their doctor and say, hey, Amoxiclav is causing these remissions in people with ME/CFS, so can you give me some? I don't think that's going to work. So if we can come up with something that is over the counter, that patients can self-experiment for themselves, I think that'll be really good for spreading this treatment and helping a lot more people. For probiotics, we have a very specific chosen ones for our protocol. And Tamara, my experiment partner, her background was actually in systems ecology. And so she's always thinking about the community and the gut. And like you mentioned, certain ones taking over. So for our experiment, we actually took probiotics beforehand that are not killed by Amoxiclav. So we knew we'd have some bacteria left in our gut when we were on the antibiotics. Then while taking them, we took specific probiotics that produce tryptophan metabolites and butyrate. And so in that case, you're using the antibiotics, so that's sort of keeping the whole population low. And then you're adding in specific ones that are producing these metabolites that can affect the brain and inflammation. And then afterwards, then we do try to recolonize the gut with probiotics. And it is hard to know how things are going to level out, what's going to happen with the community after something like this. So I think that's where FMT can be really useful if you're sort of transplanting a whole community that might be able to take over. I think the microbiome is something that isn't really completely understood. There's a lot to learn still. So we're not really sure long-term what's going to happen. We're doing microbiome testing with BiomeSight throughout the whole experiment and longer term here. So we can see exactly how the bacteria changed in our guts. And I still have I have 3 kits back there. So we'll still keep doing it for the next few months and see how things changed over time, how things evened out afterwards. And if the probiotics that we're taking make a difference by looking at the testing, but also how we're feeling. You know, we had these major baseline increases after our last remissions. So mine was the 2009 and tomorrow is 2019. Not only did we have these level two events, our baselines improved long-term. So there's something, you know, if it was gut mediated, we came out of it in a better state. But yeah, I think it's still up in the air how much probiotics do affect your system and how they could permanently colonize if you're not continually taking them. Definitely.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have a one and done kind of big pill that you swallow that makes it through to the gut and recolonizes it, but it just doesn't exist. I mean, when our stomach's working properly, the pH is kind of like a vulture's or something. It's got like, you know, 1 and 1.5 pH sort of level. So it's hard to take something orally that persists in the numbers that can recolonize the gut. But then a fecal microbiota transplant, when people kind of actually understand what you have to do that, it's worth it if you've got, it's worth it if it's going to work, right? Or because you only, you just need to do that once. Or if you've got life-threatening C. difficile, then doctors are just going to do that for you. But you can look up, you know, I'll let the listener look up how you do an FMT yourself, and it ain't pretty. And it's not even that easy, I don't think. And it's definitely not risk-free. So there's all of these barriers, but if we can really work out, you know, a time-dependent, reliable way to test and treat these different ailments through mitochondria and the gut, then I honestly think there's a whole swathe of disorders which seem unrelated but could be treated to a high degree at a stroke.
Yeah, I just read Chris Palmer's book recently, and you're talking about all these different conditions, how we kind of put them into buckets, that these are all different, but they're all issues with mitochondria underneath. I agree with that. Yeah. For the FMT, I do hope that it'll become more available from the medical community rather than people having to do it themselves. And sort of finding good donors that consistently have good outcomes for people is another important thing. I think, you know, there is always the risk of not knowing how it's going to affect you and getting worse afterwards. But a lot of the people who have these conditions are so sick that the risk is worth it to them. And that's, you know, that's why a lot of people self-experiment. But Tamara and I are always talking about like risk versus benefit. Yes, there's going to be risk to some things, but each person has their individual risk-benefit analysis. And so for the FMT, I do know quite a few people who have done it themselves at home and have had improvements. That was like in the paleo world before I even got involved with the remission biome stuff. I heard a lot about that.
The last thing before we finish up, you talked at the start about the colonoscopy prep working for someone. What does that consist of? And where the level two event or events, were they permanent or complete?
I just came across a few of these. I think it was like the oral drink that you take, that sort of cleans everything out. I think at least one or two that I saw did have baseline increase afterwards. I feel like the other ones did not. It was just a quick remission, and then a few days later they were back to where they were before. But I think even seeing these quick remissions really tells us something about what's happening. So there's like the two parts that we're interested in: the curricular mission. How can that happen? How can the switch flip and night and day? You know, I go to bed, I wake up and feel amazing. That tells you something about what's happening in the system. And then the baseline increase could be some other mechanism. And not everybody gets the baseline increase. So as we experiment more and find more of these stories, find out what it takes to get the baseline increase and what different interventions can cause these remissions. Like I said, you know, people say, what's the saying, like anecdotes do not make data or something. To us, it's like each anecdote could give you a clue about something that's happening. And you put all those together and you look at these different clues and you compare to the systems model that we're thinking, that could give us information that will help us understand a lot.
Yeah, I'd be dead curious about if someone has their appendix out as well, whether that could affect things. You know, is it possible to come back from serious gut problem? Is it harder without your appendix, or is it easier? You know?
Yeah, it could be easier if you don't have that population left in the appendix to recolonize, if it was a bad population to begin with. But I haven't heard of anybody having remissions from that. We're still trying to collect stories. As people reach out to me and tell me they have these, I have them fill out a Google form so I can keep track of all of them.
Yeah, and you think about these sort of things that are seen as fringe or wild and woolly, like coffee enemas or whatever. Mm. And I always think that if people say they feel better, then they probably felt better, you know? Folk on average aren't making things up.
Yeah.
Folk on average don't have the time or inclination to talk rubbish in public. And so every time I hear something like that, I'm the same. It feels like important information potentially that might give a clue. Like when a patient came into David Unwin's office when he was about to quit medicine more than 10 years ago, and her numbers had improved. She looked great. She lost weight. And he said, "How did you do it?" Whereas other doctors aren't saying, "How did you do this?" They're writing it off as some kind of inexplicable paradox.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you're doing is amazing. And I love to see it. Where can people find you and get involved?
So we have a website, remissionbiome.org. And then we're really active on Twitter. So again, it's just Remission Biome is our group Twitter. I'm just Tess Failer. And then my partner Tamara is Chydorina, Chydorina. And then Isabel, our third team leader, I would call it. Isabel Burnett RD, I think. So if you go to remissionbiome.org or you go to the Twitter, you'll find links to a lot of different resources. We have like YouTube videos. Tamara's been doing a lot of videos on Twitter that are just helpful in general about a lot of different comorbidities and helping a lot of people, even if they don't do the full remission biome protocol.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again, Tess. I really, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you. This is fun.
Thanks for listening, everyone, or watching the Al Houston Transforms podcast. Please hit subscribe wherever you're watching or listening so you don't miss out on future episodes. Please leave a review. It takes 30 seconds and it really helps get the messages out there. And if you or anyone you know could benefit from a metabolic mental health tune-up, head over to metsci.com, where myself and psychiatrist Dr. Rachel Brown coach you to better mental health.